This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Without further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome to the stage Julia Wheeler, John Rendell and Christian the Lion.
Christian the Lion in spirit rather than in person, I think you'll probably be glad to hear. Hello, good morning, and welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival, and in particular to this event, which is the first event of the whole 4 days, and a wonderful one to kick off with, absolutely fantastic story, which is contained in this book. Oh. So, welcome to Stamfords, John. Let's go back to 1969. Perhaps you could paint a picture of yourself way back when.
Well, first of all, you were still at school, so you won't remember. London then was really somewhere everyone in the world wanted to come to. It was really thriving with music, fashion, art, music, of course, with the Beatles and the Stones. And I grew up in Australia, and it was just like a magnet for all Australians to come here. And a number of my friends had come first. Jermaine Greer was my English lecturer, so she was telling us, you've got to get over here. Clive James and Martin Sharp and Richard Neville had started Oz magazine, which of course was quite controversial at the time. The Redfern Gallery had a lot of talented young Australian artists who were very successful here, Brett Whiteley at the Whitechapel. It was just had to come here. And 11 of us left together. We'd finished at university. We all came, and we all made our way to London, and it was just everything we expected it to be. But a lion wasn't on the agenda at that stage.
Okay. And you had long hair and bell bottoms, I'm thinking?
Well, I mean, one had to, you know, fashion was just so exciting and so different then, you know.
You needed to fit in.
Well,
in Chelsea.
I got a job in the King's Road, and of course, there was a shop called Granny Takes a Trip opposite that were making all the clothes for David Bowie and Hendrix and the Stones. And, you know, you just had to be in it to win it, really.
And so how did it come about that you were able to go in that year to Harrods and buy a lion cub?
Well, one of the reasons that I wanted to go to Harrods was because there was a friend of mine from called Barry Asherton Chin, a very beautiful Australian girl who was then married to the American ambassador in Rome. And she'd been painted by Pietro Annigoni. And he'd had a very successful exhibition in London. And they'd been to San Lorenzo restaurant to celebrate. And Pietro said to Barry, oh, let's go to Harrods and I'll buy you a present. They ended up in the pet department. And, of course, they were quite in celebratory mood. And Barry very frivolously said, I'd like a camel. And without batting an eyelid, the manager said, well, would that be with one hump or two, madam? And I just thought it was such a ridiculous story. And first of all, growing up in Australia, David Jones was our Harrods of Sydney, if you like, and they didn't have a pet department, certainly not a zoo, and it just seemed such an extraordinary thing. And so I thought, I've just got to go and see this sophisticated shop where you could buy an exotic animal. And they were quite legally allowed to do so then, because the Endangered Species Act didn't come in until 1976, which forbade the trade in exotic animals. So although, you know, some people said, oh, Harrods were doing something really monstrous, they looked after the animals there very well, and we found that out after the first reaction of seeing Christian in this tiny cage with his sister. We thought, you know, this is really not very nice. But we came back a couple of times, and came back later in the day, and realised that the cubs were not out on display all the time. And they spent a lot of time out the back with one particular girl, Sandy Lloyd, who looked after them. And they were very well looked after. And Harrods were also quite responsible, because they said, look, they are for sale, but not to the first person who wants to buy them. You have to prove that you're going to be able to look after them and afford to look after them too. And so in those days, Harrods closed at 5:30, can imagine now. And so we go back each afternoon and play with them and to realise, would we be able to look after them? And it was a very, very responsible thing of Harrods to do because, in fact, we realised very quickly we couldn't look after two.
And so how did you choose Christian and not his sister?
Well, he was much calmer. Now, subsequently, found out, knowing a lot more about lions, the lionesses tend to be a little more edgy anyhow. And she would hiss at people, and she was obviously uncomfortable, but he would just, like, look straight through you as if you weren't there. It was, you know, a real challenge. And he was calmer, and when we were playing with them, he was gentler. You still had to be careful because their claws were unclipped, and their teeth, it's like needles at that age. They're really pretty. Got to be very careful.
So Harrods were very careful about you. How much thinking had you done about how this was actually going to work and how it might impact on your 1960s lifestyle?
Well, the first thing we had to do was to find somewhere to live. And fortunately, I had a job in a furniture shop called Sophisticat, and so I managed to persuade the manageress, a wonderful girl called Jennifer Mary Taylor, and the two owners, John and Barnard Diston and Joe Harding, that to have a lion in the shop would do no harm. It'd be quite... He would be the ultimate Sophisticat. And they agreed. But they had to... Their input was very important. And also we had a daily called Kay Jew, who she had to agree because while she was vacuuming the shop or cleaning the flat, Christian was running around chasing her dusters and, you know, getting in the way, but she was completely unfazed. And then, of course, some Derek Catani came along who took all these wonderful photographs that you've been looking at. And Derek was a Fleet Street photographer, very experienced, particularly in sporting events, and so he was great at getting all Christian's all the movements and things, and so he became part of what really was Christian's pride, human pride, because the attractive thing about lions is that they're the only feline that lives in a family. Because if you see a tiger with another tiger, they're mating or something. You would see a tiger, leopards by themselves. If you see more than one leopard, it's a family. Or a mother and cubs or something, because they're solitary animals. Whereas a lion, of course, is not. It's a pride animal. It has to be in its family. And if it doesn't have its family, it's terribly lonely. And it's looking around, whereas, if you had a leopard and there's no one around, it just doesn't care. It's not interested in anyone else, not even other leopards. But lions are always looking for family and companions. And that's why if you're on safari, and I'm sure many of you have seen this on safari, but if you come across a pride of lions, they've always got tails draped on each other or paws on each other. They're all very tactile, and they like to be as a family. And also, that's the only way they can efficiently hunt. A leopard can hunt very efficiently by itself. Lions, not so efficiently by themselves, particularly the males, because they're too heavy and too big. And that was something we learnt later about... how the pride works, because there's always this thing like, say, oh, the male, he's lazy, he just sits around and waits for the girls to do everything. But in fact, it's a very well thought out process. The lion may decide when they're going to hunt. The lionesses go off first because they're lighter and they're faster. And so they all fan out, and I hope some of you have seen this, it's an extraordinary operation. None of this we knew when I bought Christian and Harrods. This has all come along later, of course. The lionesses fan out, and somehow, even if they're not within sight each other, they seem to know there's some kind of signal that the hunt will begin. They will go out, because they're faster and lighter, they will be able to grab the zebra or the wildebeest or sometimes even a buffalo. But often, of course, they actually, even if there are a couple of them, they won't actually be able to kill it. By that time, the male has caught up, and he will come in because of his extra weight. He will do the coup de grace and suffocate it or do the kill. So it's a very efficient... It works very well with their speed and his strength. But to start with Christian, it was all just learning, but day by day, really.
How did that hierarchy work within the London Pride? Who was top cat, as it were?
Well, in a Pride, there are often two alpha males. So if Ace and I were the alpha males, then there was Jennifer Mary, who was his surrogate mother, and then he had all the various uncles and aunts around. But so it wasn't unusual to have two males looking after him at all. I mean, again, this is something we found out later.
But obviously he had more of the potential to hurt you than the other way round. So you had to sort of learn submissive lion behaviour at times as well, didn't you?
What we were very fortunate, we met a girl called Unity Bevis, who'd been an actress in Rome, in Cinecittà, and she'd worked for Fellini, and she'd had a lioness. And she came into the shop, she's only 5 foot tall, and she came into the shop one day and she said, oh, I used to have a lioness in Rome, I'd like to meet yours. And we thought, oh, you know, this is a made-up story, you know. And we said, look, he's asleep. Anyhow, she came back day after day, and eventually we thought, oh, well, let's see what happens. Well, it was an absolute breakthrough for us because she had learnt with Lola, her lioness, to control the lion, you could only do it by voice and behaviour. There was no way, of course, physically you can do it because at some point the lion is going to become stronger than you. So what she taught us and what Christian hopefully never learnt, the point where he was stronger than us. And her voice training was so effective that things like if he got too rough, she would just stand still and just ignore him. And again, back to the sociable. Thanks. That's the worst thing you could do, was to leave him alone. So we obviously followed that pattern. And the only time, and when we exercised him in the churchyard just up the road, the King's Road, we never let him chase us because that would get too rough. He always had to make him chase footballs. And the only time we let him chase us was... that's jumping ahead. Should I say that? No. We'll
later.
Come to that, yeah.
So the practicalities, because actually lions are nocturnal animals, aren't they? But he kind of changed his stance on that.
That was the most unnatural thing we did. He put him to sleep at night because their eyesight is better, is very acute at night, very effective for hunting. Obviously he didn't have to do any hunting. He wasn't missing out on anything. But we did reverse the pattern. And they do sleep a lot. They sleep 12, 15 hours a day.
You sort of had to wake him up for food and things. And what did he eat and how did you procure that?
Well, again, Harrods were very responsible. They gave us a dietary sheet with four meals. And so he's fed four times a day, which, of course, would never happen in the wild. And that's why he was so healthy and so large, really, because he'd had these four meals a day. There were two liquid meals with Complan, Pharex, raw eggs and some vitamins, and then two solid meals, which were meat with bone meal on it and some, again, more additives. So he was very well fed, and that's by the time we got him to Kenya, and George Adamson just said, this cannot be a one-year-old lion.
Yeah, he's just done so well from that diet. So you've been terribly nonchalant talking about, you know, when we exercised him on the King's Road, and you and his London Pride had got used to him.
Yeah.
But what was the reaction of people, you know, who just came across a lion on the street?
Well, again, you know, this stage in the 60s, so much was unsurprising. There were other people who had big cats in London. Obviously, John Aspinall had his tigers, which he used to bring up from Fort Howlett occasionally, from Fort Limp or Howlett's, and there was another.
So he was growing, you were looking after him, obviously you become hugely fond of him and people came into the shop to see him and so on. What was it that first made you think that this isn't a long-term plan?
George and Joy Adamson, and we hadn't even seen the film at that stage, but they told us about the problems they'd had making that film, and that film had been made with circus lights. You can let a leopard out of a cage and never see it again, and it'll be fine. It'll kill the first thing that comes across, and it'll be okay. Lions have to be built into a pride, and within that pride, they have to learn how to hunt together. And so that's why George was able to do that with Christian, because Christian would follow him, Christian would come back, Christian would made the connection with the other lions to build a lion pride. But that was only possible because Christian learned to... We transferred our relationship to him, to George. Well, the first thing was that we'd come from the World's End in Chelsea, and when we got to Cora, which was then a reserve, and George said, well, you've come to the other World's End. It was a pretty tough part of Kenya, but it was the only part that was available to us because no one was going to let George rehabilitate lions in a national park. We had to find a deserted area, a virtually deserted area. And so when we saw it, we thought, gosh, this is pretty grim. And, of course, poor Christian, he'd been running around on nice lawns in Chelsea and driving around the back of a Bentley. Suddenly he was kind of on nasty sand and driving around the back of a Land Rover on straw. You know, he's kind of thinking, now, what's happening here? But, no, I tell you, he knew as soon as he saw those other lions, that's where you could just see the excitement. And the first lion he met was the little cub Catania, 3 months old, and then he had to meet the fully grown lion boy. Now, for a fully grown male to accept an immature male from a different pride, different family, is not a natural thing at all. Because, you know, when a lion, an alpha lion, takes over a new pride, he tends to kill the cubs so that his own genes will be perpetuated. So Christian had to build up this relationship, and that was pretty scary because boy did not like a young, immature male around. But Christian, of course, was absolutely fascinated because he'd never seen his own father. He'd been taken away from his father and mother when he was born in Ilfracombe Zoo down in Devon, because in captivity, lionesses don't always make great mothers, either due to inexperience or also a kind of loss of interest in life. If you're living in somewhere pretty grim, they just don't really make great mothers. So Christian and his sisters were taken away. So he'd only seen his sister, that was nearly a year ago, and suddenly to see a lion four times your size, he was just hero-worshipped. But it took a while to establish that relationship.
And so the young cub, Catania, she created a sort of bridge between them, didn't she?
She was intrigued by him. And it was already an interesting relationship that she created with Boy, because a mature male is not really usually very interested in cubs, certainly not his own. But he and Catania and Boy had created this bond, and George used her as an intermediary, so she would come in and play with Christian, go back to Boy's compound, and of course he'd grimace when he smelt Christian. And then eventually the time came that they had to meet outside. And that's when in some of the photographs that Derek's taken, which are the only photographs Derek's ever taken in his life, I think, which are a bit shaky. But it was because, we really didn't know what would happen with Christian and Boy. It was risky, but George was confident it was going to be okay, because they had about 6 or 7 days of being charging each other between the wire. And... It was a very emotional moment, because we thought, you know, here we've come all this way. He's had this extraordinary life. It would be a disaster if he was killed at this stage. But fortunately, Boy just came and he just clouted him, and it was just to show, look, I'm the boss. And Christian rolled over on his back and did exactly the right response. And so, thank heavens. And so we could, you know, relax and think, no, it's not going to kill him.
So George Adamson's plan was to build a pride at Cora, and Christian's going to be part of that, but it didn't all go according to plan to start with, did it?
No, it was very tough time for George and Christian, because started off with the three, and they became welded, and they would go off for walks every day by themselves, and so they would familiarise themselves with the territory. And of course they would be attracted to the down to the Tana River, which basically where all the action was, where the other animals would be, come down to water. And then one day Christian came back by himself. And George thought, well, you know, that's a little bit unusual, because normally Catania would come back with him if Boy wanted off. And then a day later, Boy came back by himself with no Catania. And so he realised something had gone wrong, went down to the riverbank, and a couple of days later found where they'd been playing on the bank. Boy, they'd all crossed the river, but only Boy and Christian had reached the other side, which meant that Catania, who was much lighter, was probably swept downstream and most probably taken by a crocodile. So that was a real setback, the only female now gone. And as George said, you know, the life seemed... Boy and Christian were very depressed. They really missed it because, you know, as I said, they're a family animal, so if one goes missing, there really is an impact.
So you left, you'd said goodbye to Christian, and how much did you keep in touch with George? How much did you know what was going on with Christian?
Well, George was a very good correspondent, and he wrote regularly saying how Christian was getting on. He told one very funny story about one day that he was out there with them, the lions, and there was a mature rhino just grazing up ahead of them. And Boy took one look and just, you know, well, it's a mature rhino, you keep out of their way. So he peeled off, and Christian decided to stalk it. And George thought, oh, here we go, this is going to be exciting. So he always carried a rifle in case, you know, to scare something off or something, it was an accident. Christian got closer and closer and closer to this rhino, who eventually looked up, spotted him, and of course was totally outraged by this cub stalking him. And next thing, all George saw was this kind of Christian hurled through the air and dust everywhere. He doesn't know whether he just leapt out of the way or whether the rhino had gored him out of the way. And how the rhino stomped off, and Christian just ran straight back to camp. He was absolutely terrified. And he always says that the look on Boy's face, as Boy looked over and seen what had happened, and if he said if rhinos could speak, we know what he would have been saying. Absolute scorn.
So I guess it's one thing to hear about it from a distance, but ultimately you wanted to go back and see whether, you know, see for yourself how things were going. Do you remember your emotions in the sort of the run-up to that when you were back in London and thinking about going?
Well, there was another factor involved, which is another tragedy, which we'd been given two lionesses, so the pride is growing. But they were having, Boy, and they were having to fight for their territory because the resident lions were not going to give it up easily. And Boy was very badly injured and his back was gored open. And the vet, Sue Harthorn and Layla Trevor, had to patch him up. And although they did, he never really was the same again. And I think it's like any of us. If you've got a bad back and you're in permanent pain, he was always in a bad mood. And this was not a good sign. Even George said he was getting, you know, with Christian, he was getting distanced. And unfortunately, George's assistant, Stanley, was never allowed to leave camp without a guard. One day went out, and George heard all this screaming, rushed out and found Stanley in Boy's jaws. And so he had to shoot Boy. And so this was really a disaster for Christian as well, a tragedy for all of us. And it also put the whole project in danger. But fortunately, George had enough support to be able to continue with the rehabilitation program and with Christian. And once all that had settled down, that's when he said, you can come out and see him. And so, of course, we were really overexcited to come and see Christian.
So I think we'll let film take over here.
Okay.
I can imagine that it was an emotional time. Did you have any particular expectations?
Well, I just hoped he would remember us, and we were pretty sure he would, because, you know, he'd spent half his life with us looking after him 24/7. So.
But there's always that danger that, you know, out of sight, out of mind. Let's see, if we may, how that panned out. Lovely. I think that deserves a round of applause.
Yes, it was extraordinary that, you know, there was Christian, the English-born lion, and yes, you win the tearing prize, Janie. You cried most. She's only seen it about 10 times. That was the most unexpected, the least expected thing. They're after these tragedies of the naturally born lioness, Catania, and boy not making. Here a year later, here is Christian with his lionesses making a success of it. So it really was an occasion to be very proud of him. You know, we thought, you know, the boy done well.
So he started to become habituated, but how much was George still seeing him and keeping an eye on him? How much did he come back to the camp at that time?
Well, he was seeing less and less of him because he was wandering off with the lionesses. And this time when we saw him, he hadn't been seen for a couple of weeks, I think. And yet when we turned up, Christian was there. So that's quite an interesting possibility. But the next year we went back to see him again. He was much more, not distant, but he was just much more mature.
But did he still recognise you?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Oh, yes. And he it took him about a week to come back. But George thought that's probably because of the distance he'd travelled, because he had to mark out his own territory with his pride. And so he came back and he spent just a couple of days with us, and then off he went. And it was as if, you know, like, okay, I've touched base, everything's fine, I've got lion things to do. But by then he was nearly 500 pounds, which was enormous for a lion up in that area, because they're desert lions up there, as you saw in some of the footage, what a tough part of the world it was, that the lions are not like the ones you see in the Maasai Mara or in the Kruger or Serengeti, where you see these wonderful big-maned lions. The local lions up there were much smaller, and Christian would have been quite different from them.
And so did you ever feel any fear, either from him or from the other lions in the pride?
Not when he was around, but you wouldn't want to be out there without him.
But you kind of felt he got your back.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, absolutely, yes, because once the two lionesses tried to ambush Ace and me, and he dove in and chased them off. So you really have to be very careful around them, even if you know them terribly well, because of their weight, you know, they can fall against you or jump or knock you over accidentally. You always have to be very careful. And it's amazing that George, you know, quite slight figure like him, never really had a serious injury, but he was just always careful around them.
What was it about George, do you think, that was so special in terms of his relationship with lions? And I mean, he just sounds in the book like an amazing person.
Yes, he was an amazing man. I think he was born in India, educated in Cheltenham, then went back to Kenya and lived there for the rest of his life, mostly in the bush, or virtually always in the bush. And I think, like anyone who lives completely with nature, you're a very balanced person. So he knew Africa incredibly well in terms of all the plants, the animals, the local people. And out of that, he had acquired a great deal of wisdom. And he was very calm. When he met Christian the first time, I admired the way he didn't rush up and touch him or anything. He was just looking at him and just assessing him. And to get to know him, he would just do odd things like give him some water or step over him, just to let Christian realize that he was, you know, he was benign. The only other person I've ever felt that kind of wisdom and calmness was when I once met Nelson Mandela, and he had that same kind of calmness about him, and you felt, my God, you know, you're in the presence of a very, very wise person. And George, I mean, he wrote very well, he spoke very well in his own time, and you can never call him a chatterbox, but at night, when you were just sitting around the fire and he had his nice little white horse whiskey, he could tell wonderful stories, marvellous stories. And we just had the impression, we knew Christian was going to be safe with him. We'd made the right decision.
And joining George's team is a chap called Tony Fitzjohn, who has gone on to do great things in Tanzania, hasn't he, in terms of almost a legacy of George and in some ways of Christian.
Well, yes, after Stanley had been so sadly killed, by coincidence, Tony Fitzjohn had turned up at Joy's house at Lake Naivasha and said, were there any jobs going? And she said, oh, my husband George needs an assistance. The last one has just been killed by a lion. So undeterred, Fitz set off, went up, and he became the final link in Christian's human pride. And so Tony Fitzjohn stayed with George for the next 18 years. He helped obviously rehabilitate Christian. And at first, George describes when Christian first saw Fitz, he was not too impressed, simply because, you know, George was not introducing him to people anymore, because then you had to get away from that. Anyhow, eventually Fitz just walked up to him and said, I'm Fitz, hi, and Christian just accepted him. And George did have an idea, so because Fitz had hair down to here like we had at the time and some rather odd clothes, and perhaps Christian thought, oh, it's another one of these odd kind of people who look after me.
So what has... Tony then had to leave Cora, so he's gone to Tanzania, hasn't
he? Yes. So what happened with... people wanted George out of Cora. There were people poaching there. Because he'd been there, there was a lot more game, so it could be poaching. Also, there were Somalis bringing their cattle down and goats down from Somalia, and they were actually on the reserve. And that interfered with George's work and also with the local people. And these people, they're rich cattle owners, so they were putting pressure to get rid of George. They managed to trump up charges and get Tony banned by spurious rifle license charges, leaving George by himself and very vulnerable. And very tragically, in 1989, he was killed by Somali herders. It was a terrible end for a marvellous man, but he went down a hero fighting these people with just a pistol, and they machine gunned him to death and two of his staff. So it was, you know, an absolute tragedy for Kenya and for him, for all of us, and as a public relations exercise for Kenya. But by which point Tony had started we'd started the George Adamson Wildlife Preservation Trust and had set up at Mkomazi in Tanzania. And today, if I can just say about Tanzania, Tony, it's one of the most successful rehabilitation and conservation projects in Africa. It's 1,500 square miles. At the moment, we've got 30 black rhino, five of whom are pregnant, which is great. Very proud of our boys down there. And we breed wild dog, hunting dog, which are another endangered species. And around the perimeter of what's now been gazetted as a national park. And really, this is why we've called this book Christian's Legacy, because without Christian starting at Cora, without George, without Fitzjohn, without the George Adamson Trust, you know, it wouldn't have happened. It may have happened another way, of course, but this just happened, really started with Christian. And around the park now, because education is very much part of our policy there, we've helped 11 schools around the edges of the perimeter of the park. And Chester Zoo have given us a bus which goes around from school to school and saying, look, protect this wildlife. Because it's a very tough part of Africa. There's nothing there. There are no minerals. There's no gold. There's no diamonds. So the Chinese aren't in there looking around. There's nothing there but the game. And so in all the schools, what we're saying, look, is the bank in the money for you and for your future. We're not trying to turn you into guides or cleaners or hotel workers, but when the tourists come, they're going to buy your mother's vegetables. They're going to buy... because that's the thing that clicks.
So let's just finish on Christian. I mean, do you imagine that there are Christian's descendants out there running around in the bush? Is that, do you know that, or do you hope that?
We don't know it. We've tried various DNA tests to see, but we just haven't worked. The main problem is Christian's DNA, because although Jennifer Mary has a fur coat he slept on, I have his collar, they can't get it, or they say they can't. But there are lions up there that are definitely not desert lions. So every now and again, one of the lodge owners or people will say, ah, we've spotted the Christian gene, because there'll be one with a larger mane or bigger boned. So we are confident. I mean, George heard him mating, so we know that something happened there. And but he crossed the river to go into Meru National Park, where he could establish his own pride. And although he was never seen again, in many ways that's, you know, that's frustrating. But that is a successful rehabilitation. You don't want them coming back every few days for a meal. And the fact that he did go, and also there was no record of a trophy, thank goodness. Because if he had been poached, he would have been by far the largest lion in the area. And that would have attracted a lot of attention from either to the, for all the wrong reasons. But we know that never happened. And also we're confident that he didn't kill any domestic cattle. He did kill one once, and the chief local village sent for George, and George came up, and there Christian was indeed even in the Gombe, a local one of their own cow, because all the villagers were all standing back terrified. So George just went up with his little stick, for the first time he ever physically hit a lion, went up and whammed Christian on the head with his little stick. He got such a shock, dropped the cow and ran off, and as far as we know, he never did it again. But there was every time he was ever, George ever hit a lion.
Isn't that a lovely story, the whole thing? It's all in here, together with Derek's wonderful pictures. You saw some of them perhaps at the beginning before we came on. Please do go and have a look at the book. And if you do have any questions, John's happy to answer them. He'll be over there at the signing desk. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks to Whitney Houston. I think we ought to give a little bit of thanks to Whitney Houston. Most of all, thanks to John Rendell.